You know, it was one of those things that I knew, we both knew, it didn't matter how much time we spent in the big leagues, how much money we made in the big leagues, that it was, there was always an end. No matter what, there's always an end to that career.
Welcome into another episode of Baseball America's From Phenom to the Farm. I'm your host, Kyle Bandujo. Today, we're talking to former TCU and big league right-hander Sam Demmel about his career. Sam grew up with Josh Beckett as his neighbor, so he had the exact template of what being a big league right-hander looks like. He went a little different path than Beckett. We talk about not quite having the draft work out as a high school senior and playing at TCU early in Jim Schlossnagel's run there as TCU went on its ascent as a powerhouse program. Sam gets into going back and forth between starting and the bullpen, spending a sophomore season doing something that I don't think we're going to see another college arm do, at least in this era. We talk about his rise into the big league bullpen and how both he and his wife took special care to prepare for life after baseball early in his career, the steps they took. Really enjoyed having Sam on, especially that perspective, thinking about life after baseball. Hope everyone enjoys listening. Episodes of Phenom to the Farm drop every other Tuesday. If you enjoy this one, subscribe wherever you get your podcast and go check out past interviews. And if you haven't yet, leave a 5-star rating and a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Also, make sure to subscribe to BaseballAmerica.com and the BA podcast feed for all amateur baseball and prospect news. The best tools lists are coming out. Always great to check those out. And we're getting pretty close to minor league baseball playoffs and year-end lists. Lots of great stuff, as always, going on at BA. Always a good time to be a subscriber. And with that, let's talk to Sam Demmel. All right, joining in for today's episode from Phenom the Farm, he's a third-round pick in the 2007 draft out of TCU, former big league right-hander Sam Demmel. Sam, thanks so much for joining from Phenom the Farm.
I appreciate you having me on.
Of course, yeah. I've been looking forward to this. As I've said, I think I've said on the show before, my wife's a TCU alum. I have hopped on the TCU fanhood bandwagon, so been looking forward to this a lot. Let's throw it back to high school, or at least your amateur ball days. When did you first realize that you had a future at the next level of baseball, whether that be college or pro ball?
Yeah, so for me, it was my freshman year in high school. Actually, a funny thing is I grew up next door to Josh Beckett, so we shared backyards. So in 99, I actually got to hear the champagne cork pop in his backyard when he went second overall, which was a really cool thing for me as a kid. And then my freshman year of high school, which would have been 2000-2001, I made varsity that year, and that's when I realized, like, okay, 5A school in Texas, making varsity as a freshman, not a common aspect. So that offseason I quit basketball. I didn't see a future in there, being 6 foot and can barely shoot and can't run.
You usually need to do one of those things.
Yeah,
you have to have one.
So I focused on baseball that offseason and saw the velocity spike, and that's my sophomore year of high school. Came all district and all of the accolades from that. So really started focusing on it full time that first off season after my freshman year, and kind of saw the progression jump tremendously between that period of time. And then going through high school and being recruited out of there, you know, honestly, I didn't think I was going to go to college. Used college as more as leverage for the draft, because that's where I really wanted to go at that point. So loved TCU. The school was in Fort Worth, which was close enough to home, but far enough away from home. And, you know, the tuition there was big. So I used that as leverage. And I think it worked against me. But at the end of the day, I got to a great school and play for Slosh and propel myself from there. But I would say, just knowingly that there was a future in it, was probably that off season between freshman and sophomore year. And then going into the senior was where I knew it was going to be professional and not just college.
Well, with that, you had, I mean, the high school right-hander template living next door to you and a couple years older with that in Beckett. And while Beckett was, you know, if it weren't for Josh Hamilton, he might've been the first high school right-hander ever drafted 1-1. Obviously, you know, he was like like 6'5", like the prototype, but you had that template to stack yourself up against. So as you're getting into senior year, and you've got your college commit, but you're evaluating pro ball, how did you evaluate yourself as a prospect, especially compared to, I mean, you know, Beckett is one of those once in a generation guys, but you had that frame of reference. How did you evaluate yourself going into the draft?
Me, it was really interesting because you know, being a 6 foot, 185 pound right-hander, there wasn't really a prominent market for that out of high school with high draft picks. And I think that's actually what helped me so much on the college route as well, because colleges looked at me as a really good high chance I was coming to them because of a 6 foot, 185 righty. And that's, you know, I got a lot of full ride offers because of that. There was a higher percentage of me coming on campus from evaluating it on the professional level. It was really interesting to see the different responses from different teams and how they were looking at me. I got a lot of teams that were looking at it as possibilities of starter, more likely a reliever back end type guy. Being, you know, even in high school, my senior year, I was 94, 96, but I had a ton of movement. And that was my big thing, was the sinkers and moving the ball around from that standpoint, the late movement. So it was, I saw myself somewhere in that back end, early second, back end, second round. And that's where I was okay with in that time period. And then when that passed, I made the decision when I got the calls in the third, fourth, and fifth from other teams of, you know, that was it. I was second round or before, or I'm going to school. And I think that helped me from that standpoint, because that's kind of borderline where I was at that period of time.
Yeah. With kind of hindsight in that, how, knowing yourself now and then knowing what, you know, you got a little taste of A ball, you know, you made it to high pretty quick, but at 18, how do you think you would have handled short season, the complex league, high A, any of those? Do you, in retrospect, do you think you were ready for something like that?
Honestly, I don't know. I'd never experienced what that was like in my career. I know going into it, I only spent 3 years in the minor leagues before I got to the big leagues, and having to do that for 5 or 6 years to work your way up, I think that would have been really brutal. The lower levels of the minor leagues is not fun. The fun part's when you're out between the lines, but the rest of it's, you know, it takes a very mature and young kid to get through that. So I think the college route helped me a ton. And most of my career was spent Triple A in the big leagues. And so having that ability to sit back on and reflect on was big from the standpoint of, I don't think I would have enjoyed the lower levels very much, even at the age of 18. I got a lot of direction, a lot of growth that happened really, really quickly in college from learning from Slosh and from the staff there. So I'm happy the route that it ended up going, for sure.
So you make it to campus, and at that time, where what we think of TCU now, so talking here in 2022, that's multiple runs to Omaha. You know, Schloss had that great run before making his move to A&M. Back then, he's on the job pretty recently. I think before you got there, they had won a conference title, but they're still kind of the proof of trying to build proof of concept and take that program to the next level. It hadn't been to Supers, anything like that. When you're coming in, and when guys are coming in, you're making the choice to go to that program. Like, and like you said, you'd had a lot of other offers and stuff like that. What makes you buy into a program like that and believe in that there is that ceiling? Cause I doubt you would pick somewhere where you didn't think there was the ceiling to make the run to Omaha. Cause that's what, you know, 99% of college baseball players are there for.
Absolutely. You know, the interesting thing is if I graduated high school in 2005 and not 2004, I never would have went to TCU, because TCU moved from Conference USA into the Mountain West Conference my sophomore year. And I never would have went to TCU with them in the Mountain West Conference. And with Conference USA, the competition was way better, and it was a good baseball conference at that time. So timing has a lot to do with everything. You know, Todd Whitting was the recruiting coordinator at TCU at my time, and he had been recruiting me for about 2 years to go to U of H. And I had a really good relationship with him. He went radio silent on me for about 2.5 weeks, which was crazy for him. He would call every chance he got, answer they would allow. So he called me up and said, "Hey, I know you know nothing about this place. You haven't been recruited by him. You don't know anything. I want you to jump on a plane and fly out here. Come check it out, just out of respect for me." And that's the only reason I ever ended up at TCU is because of Todd Whitting. The campus was phenomenal. The facilities were great. And I knew what was going on with Whitting and Slosh. And you could get that vibe of how that was going to grow. And the knowledge base that come out of it was phenomenal. So I was actually in Slosh's first recruiting class. And it, you know, was me, Matt Carpenter, You know, Andrew Walker, a lot of guys that played professionally. Obviously, Carpenter's made it pretty well. Good name for himself.
He's done decent. Yeah, you could say.
It takes that dynamic and that personality of guys to trust in it and to run with it. We didn't accomplish what we wanted to, but I think we set the base for that springboard into what TCU has become.
I always like asking about the first fall because guys are coming in. Most high schoolers, especially guys like yourself who had draft attention, never really struggled. Most high school hitters aren't touching you. You can get fastballs by them. Never been in like a rigorous program, college program like that. And then you're adapting like any other freshman. You're 18. You're learning to be on your own for the first time. How did you handle the adjustment to college and college baseball?
I think for me, the biggest adjustment was classroom. Just trying to get through classes and creating your own schedule and just that aspect of it. From the baseball side, for me, it was always, once I got between the lines, I didn't have any issues with anything. It was more of the confidence, the cocky arroganceness of when I'm on the mound. I didn't have any reservations at that point. My struggle with performance wise came probably a couple of weeks into the freshman year of trying to learn how to get extended and go through at games. And the pace picks up a little bit at college, but it's more along the lines of smarter hitters, better hitters, and getting through lineups for the second time. And that didn't hit me in the fall. We were a pretty young team and everybody was kind of learning together on that aspect of it. But the time management and just starting to turn baseball into more of a career and less of a extracurricular, if you want to say it that way, that really started that freshman year. But I found myself at the field more than in the study hall and focusing on that side of it. And then by junior year, it was just more along the lines of prepping and getting ready to go off.
I was going to ask, because with that Conference USA schedule, I know a lot of baseball players, you majored baseball first and whatever you're taking classes in second. But that Conference USA travel schedule, I was kind of looking at what the away trips are required with that. It's Hattiesburg, it's St. Louis, it's Memphis, Charlotte. I mean, not short trips. It's not like the Big 12 schedule, although conferences now we're looking at just one big blob, but not a lot of bus rides. When you're that first freshman year, when you're managing, you got to stay eligible. So when you're managing that, you're managing long flights, fortunately DFW, you can get direct to anywhere, but stuff like that, like how difficult is the transition from, just high school classes to managing that college course load, staying eligible with that increased travel?
You pad your schedule in the spring to where it's pretty soft and you take the harder courses in the fall. You know,
that's the move.
A lot of communication classes in the spring and as tedious, I guess, or as hard. I think I took sports management twice in the spring and they do a pretty good job of understanding and working around the schedules. But and you'll also notice that a good number of guys were in the same classes. So, but the travel schedule, yeah, I mean, it's brutal. It's a little worse now too. I think they play two games midweek and, you're leaving on a Thursday and you're coming back on a Sunday night. You got a 9 a.m. class on Monday morning and then you roll right back out on Tuesday and go play. And it can be pretty daunting, but the schools do a pretty good job of working with us.
So you're roll heading into the spring. Obviously, I'm sure like most guys on the staff, you're gunning for that one of those weekend starter spots. You did make a lot of starts that spring. When you're gunning for that weekend job, there's older guys there who have been, eyeing that, those weekend roles for years. And with you, especially with how the rest of your career went, kind of juggling between starting in the pen, how did you evaluate yourself and thinking, I deserve to be a starter, I want to be a starter, versus what might have been best for your skill set?
Yeah, it was interesting for me that the career there at TCU. My freshman year, I knew I had a weekend rotation spot coming in to the spring after the fall. Lance Broadway was the number one. Obviously, I mean, he was runner up in the Golden Spikes that year with 15-1 record. I mean, it was pretty Nintendo numbers he put up. And then aside from that, we had a transfer from Nebraska and Brad Furnish, who was a second round pick. And you know, I knew the three of us were coming into the weekend to start that year. And so when I went into it, it was more along the lines of trying to learn from Lance as much as I could and figure out how to stretch games out. You know, coming out of high school, you have that mentality that you're going to strike everybody out. You're going after the punch out on everybody you face. And when you start getting 8-9-inning games and better lineups and you're at 100 pitches in 5 innings, it's not a good thing. So I was learning from that. The switch to the bullpen my sophomore year, I was a Friday night guy my sophomore year, start of the season. And I want to say I was somewhere around 5-1, 6-1 with a good ERA, and we were doing really well on Fridays. And then Saturdays, Arrieta was doing really well going through the sixth or seventh inning. And then our bullpen was struggling at the time. And Slosh comes up to me and we're at BYU, and he comes up to me, he goes, "Hey, you got the most recovery. Your arm bounces back the quickest. What are your thoughts on closing Friday or Saturday and starting on Sunday for us?" And so, you know, being a, you know, 20-year-old kid wanting the team to win, I was like, "Yeah, let's do it." So, you know, we look back at that transition where, you know, out of the bullpen, I was dominant. And then my starts after that period of time, ERA started to go up and everything started to happen from that standpoint. But it was outing number two of the weekend, stretching, trying to get to the seventh or eighth inning after closing on Friday night or Saturday night. And Sunday was pretty brutal. So after that that year, Slosh and I sat down and he said, "You know, you kind of need to choose which route you want to go." And I just said, "Which route's best for the team?" I go, "I'm going to go out to the Cape and I'm going to close. I can't put too many more innings on my arm this year just from doing the dual kind of role." And so we went that route, and I made that decision from the standpoint of, I knew that's where a lot of teams saw me in the future. And I thought it might help kind of getting accustomed to that role that I've never done before. And it's kind of how everything started, from the relief role going into my junior year and staying put in that situation.
Yeah, it's kind of the reverse Lincecum, where Washington would throw him on, start him on Friday, and then he'd close on Sunday. They don't usually ask kids to do that anymore. So it's an interesting little throwback.
It's always the 6-foot righty too, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. No, they're not putting the 6'7" horse out doing that. With that, I mean, you made the choice for, you know, where you profiled in pro ball and things like that. But when you switch to just the back end of the bullpen, both in the Cape and full time at TCU, it seems to agree with you. What about that agreed with your skill set, with your mentality? Like, what did it, how does it change your strategy, you know, pitching the ninth or pitching, you know, coming in the seventh to finish out versus starting out in the first inning? Where's the change in Sam, the guy that on the mound?
For me, I loved it because I got to then attack hitters I wanted punch outs. I wanted to strike people out and I wanted to attack them and not so much have to worry about game management and what is it going to be like the second time through the lineup. It was my best stuff against them and go for it and don't worry about getting ready for a second or third time through the lineup. It's more of a kind of a bulldog mentality of screw you, here it comes. And the other thing for me, what I loved is I knew every day that there was a chance I was going to play. And as a starter, you know, and I finished up with LA and AAA with them and kind of switched back into that starter role for a little bit. And I enjoyed the change of pace. But man, pitching once every 5 days gets kind of boring. You don't have the opportunity to get in every day. For me, it was more of a job at that point at the end of my career, but I enjoyed it. But I love the ability to know that I can come in, close out a game and finish it off and, you know, just go out and blow it out. And just let it all stay out there. It was much more fun for me, and I thought there was a lot more pressure in the ninth than there ever is in the first through fifth.
You mentioned the Cape. Cape's kind of for top prospects, at least, got the quintessential college baseball summer experience. The exposure, you know, scouts everywhere, the history of the league, you know, kind of the charm of it being in that area, playing those high school fields. How much do you actually develop as a pitcher in the Cape? Like, how much better do you get?
I would say if you do it correctly, tremendously better. And the reason why, what I learned how to do in the Cape, which was terrifying in college with an aluminum bat, was pitch inside. I learned how to attack hitters on the inner half of the plate and have confidence in that as opposed to with aluminum bat, you run a fastball in on somebody's hands and they hit a little blooper out to left. Or you run a little cutter in on a lefty and he gets a little bit of barrel on it and he gets a double down the line off of you. You put a wood bat in their hands and you execute that pitch, that bat's shattered and it's pop up to the third. The confidence that it brings from learning how to do that and execute translates so much more, even pitching to aluminum bats, because then you have the confidence to do it. I think that was the biggest thing for me was learning how to really utilize the inner half. And you're facing better hitters, more well-rounded lineups, and it's preparing you for that next level. I wouldn't say from the coaching standpoint, they're not teaching you anything from a mechanical. It's more of just picking their brain on, you know, where they've been, how they've attacked, what they've seen work. But it's not a mechanical league. It's just an experience league, learning how to execute.
And kind of touching on what you said earlier, you know, as you mentioned, you guys do make the switch into the Mountain West while you're in school. Did, you know, you said you wouldn't have attended TCU if they had been in the Mountain West. Did it make for that much of a difference when you were in there in the moment?
I think the competition wasn't as good top to bottom through the conference. You know, we had series where you're playing a very subpar team. And I don't really know what it is like now over there. I know TCU being in the Big 12, there's not really a night you're taking off and or that you can let down. That was for me when it came to, you'd have some nights where I knew if I missed over the middle of the plate, it was fine because stuff wise was about to be able to produce. I wouldn't have made that decision with that. I was wanting the competition and the ability to host a regional and host a super regional and get to the College World Series. And it's impossible to do that. And not impossible because TCU did end up doing it, but we had years where I think my junior year, we should have been hosting without a question. And we end up at Rice as a number two seed. And the competition and strength of schedule has a lot to do with that.
With that too, when you're at TCU, Lupton is still pretty brand new. I mean, it's still nice park, top tier college baseball facility. And over the last 20 years, a lot of the programs in the sport have upgraded their facilities. We've got a lot of, you know, most top tier schools have pitching labs, all these things. In your time through like 05 to 07, what was the disparity like in facilities? Like, were there weekends where you're like, man, we got to go play in a dump compared to what you've got sitting at home at with Lupton?
I mean, there are some places that you have to go that are miserable. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter where you're at, what level you're at. You're going to go to ballparks that are not ideal conditions. And from the big leagues to little league, I mean, there's places I went to in the big leagues that if I never went back again, I was totally happy with that.
My college ballpark, I played at a D2 school and we were that place no one wanted to go to, which we kind of relished in, honestly.
Yeah, I would say probably the worst place that I ever went to was Air Force and had nothing to do with the facilities. It's just every time we went there, it was sleeting and 15 degrees and you just do it. But ballpark wise, you're going to have some bad ones. I'll tell you what, the worst one I ever played in the minor leagues was Bakersfield in California. After every game, we had to pack our bags up and put them on the top of the lockers just in case it rained because the locker room would flood. Oof. I mean, so it makes you stronger. It builds you through those things. And those are some of the things I still remember to this day.
You live in Fort Worth now. So where your alma mater is it easier or harder to root for your alma mater when you're no longer in control of the outcome?
It's, you know what? I enjoy it. I don't make it to nearly as many games as I should. We've got season tickets and I've been to 2 games in 2 years.
Tough ratio.
Yeah, so may want to rethink that one this year.
Yeah. Might not want to dox yourself. You might find someone in your seats next time.
No, it's just one of those things. It's not tough. But I'm so busy on the other side of life and everything we've got going on that I enjoy being around TCU and running into people. And that's one thing about TCU that's really interesting to me is the amount of people that go to TCU that stay in Fort Worth. It's a large contingent of graduates and students that, you know, they don't matriculate outside of Fort Worth. They stay here. They come here and they stay. So it's a little purple town now.
Definitely, definitely. So walk me through your draft experience, because you get tagged. You have a great junior season closing for TCU. You get tagged again, the kind of the short right-hander, back end of the bullpen guy. You get tagged with the thing that is, hey, this guy could move quick. You know, one of the, there's a couple of those guys in every draft where it's like the college reliever that's like, hey, this guy could be in your bullpen soon. Did you have conversations with scouts, whoever? Did you have kind of an eye on any certain team or anything like that of they might take me and move me quick, maybe start me in Double A or something like that?
Yeah, we had a couple of teams that had interest later in the first and early in the second that were looking at me for that particular reason, to move quickly through the system. But I have no idea what I know. What happened with the Yankees was, what is his name? Gosh, Andrew Brackman, if I remember right.
Yes.
He fell. They didn't expect him to be there. And then as drafts go, everything kind of changes when you get going through it. I got the phone call from Oakland at the beginning of the third, and I knew the guy pretty well. He goes, what the hell are you still doing on here? And he goes, well, if you make us, we're taking you in 10 picks. And I was like, all right, well, that's cool. But then they sent me straight to High A. It took an extra couple of weeks to get signed, kind of put me against the back wall on just getting in the system and going. And I think that hurt me more than anything. But that was also the year where everybody decided to do a 15% pay cut on signing bonuses. So I didn't know anything about it. I just told my agent, figure it out and get me going. So, you know, I went straight out to Stockton, California. Going to High A from college is a lot bigger jump than people think it is, or than I thought it was. And so there were some struggles there, and went down for the last couple of weeks of the season to Low A. And it was like pitching in high school again after seeing those guys tonight. And then kind of just went from there. But the draft process, so I don't even know how to explain it. It's, you hear something from 22 different teams of, you know, we love you, we'll do this, we'll do this. We, you know, when can you sign? What can you do? When can you be out there? And it's all just an interview process for a job. And I see it now. Then I thought I was just talking to somebody that, you know, really liked me and wanted me to go into their system and progress. But it's a business. Baseball is a business. And the further you get up and the higher you get up, the more you learn it.
You mentioned those struggles in High A. It's interesting, kind of night and day, looking at your numbers between High A, your first year in pro ball, and your second year in pro ball. Was it arm fatigue? Is it the difference in intensity? What are those differences that make it so much more of a difficult transition than you thought it would be?
I think for me, it was comfort, not feeling out of place. That first time I was there, you know, I'm 21. Most people in that league at that point were 23, 24. I think I even had a 26 and 27-year-old on my team. And you're perceived when you walk in that locker room as they've been working their way up through the system to get there. And you just get drafted and you get thrown here where they've spent the last 2 or 3 years to get to. So it's a little bit of a humbling experience to walk in there and see the professional side of it. And then that lifestyle is a lot different than college. When in college, you've got a 7 o'clock game, you're at the field at 3:30 after your classes for a 7 o'clock game. And even the minor leagues or the big leagues, I'm at the field at 12:30, 1 o'clock, and the preparation and learning how to do the pregame workouts and routines and get ready for the game. And then I think the most challenging thing that took me the longest to figure out was how to come down after those games. The adrenaline rush that you feel after those games, you know, it's 10 o'clock at night, you got to get up the next day and do it again. And you know, most people, they have to be at their peak for work performance between, you know, 9 and 5. And really, honestly, most people are between 11 and 2 when they're actually performing at their peak. And when you think about it from a baseball standpoint, you, as a reliever, I'd have to be at my peak between 9, you know, 8:30 and 10 o'clock at night. That's what took the longest for me to figure it out. And I struggled with that really bad that first year coming into High out of college.
Did you struggle at all with finding adrenaline? Because you'd gone from 3 years of closing conference games and pitching regional games and college, every game matters, especially if you're vying for a super regional spot. You kind of, from the Mountain West, you got to win out. And you're closing the Wednesday morning kids game against Fresno or whatever it might be. Like, did you have any problems finding it from within and getting amped for a minor league save situation?
I didn't. Not coming up. Like, coming up through the system trying to get to the big leagues, it was easy to find adrenaline looking at it as dominate and go up, dominate and go up. And I never struggled with it at that point. When I got sent down in Scranton, when the Yankees sent me down in spring training, 13, whatever year that was, and I was in Scranton, and I was just closing out games, and I think I had some Nintendo numbers that year too.
You did.
And there was nowhere to go. And I asked, my agent and I both asked Cashman multiple times, can you just trade me? And just, you know, just trade. His response is always, why? You're throwing really well. If we need you, we got you. And so that was the year where I was just sitting there going, what is trying to find adrenaline and trying to get up something when you know there's nowhere to go. That was the toughest part for me. And then that next year when I went to I signed with the Dodgers, had a great spring training, didn't make the team, go to Albuquerque, and you're throwing in a place where it's 30-mile-an-hour wind straight out every day, and it's Albuquerque.
You're pitching on Mars.
It was really tough there. That's why I tried to be a starter at the end of it. I was like, I just need something else for excitement, and you know, I'm not moving, I'm not going anywhere, and that was a fun one, and that was the way to end it. But yeah, going up through the system, you always see that ceiling that you can get to, and you can see that next level, and there's the adrenaline.
And once you get to AAA on the way up, so you make it to by 2010 or by 2009, you're in Sacramento and you're throwing well. You basically establish it that I am a good above average AAA bullpen guy, which means there's only one more place to go. Is it compared to how you felt in New York later in your career after you'd been in the big leagues, and it's not even like you're knocking on the door, it's like, why isn't this opening? When you're in AAA and you're on the way up, does it feel like a true next man up situation? Like, I'm the 28th man on the roster, I'm just going to wait patiently for an opening? Or are you still, is every outing like a test? I got to prove myself. This is the one that's going to get me up. Like, does patience set in, or is there still like a sense of urgency and a sense of worry every time out?
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Well, it's different for guys at different parts of their career. Actually, when I got called up to AAA, to Sacramento, when I got called in the office, I honestly thought I was going to the big leagues. And that was my mindset. You know, that was another one of those years where that first half of the year there, I want to say I gave up like 2 runs in 30 innings. And
you had a 0.61 ERA. It is hard to do that in a video game.
Yeah, it was one of those things, like everything was working and control was there. And that's, so I was kind of surprised when I went to AAA at that point. I looked at it as more of, you know, there was nothing else for me to prove in AA, and they didn't have a spot for me up there. But when I got to Sacramento and you get into that, it's really interesting. You got guys sitting in the locker room that are reading the newspaper every single morning to see if there was any injuries in Oakland that day, or, you know, it's just different vibe in the clubhouse. And for me, it was more of, I didn't understand why I wasn't having that opportunity. And that's where the business side of it comes in. It's not necessarily the progression on the field. It's more of the opportunity at that point of when it comes. And especially with Oakland, if the finances match with it and what they want to do, if they want to start your clock and things of that nature. So I got, you know, the pitching coordinator there told me that year, stay where you're going. You didn't get called up right now, but you know, you're not 40. You didn't have to be put on the 40 man at that point. I was only in year two, and they wanted to give a couple other guys opportunities to prove something in September because I was still on the younger side. And so I got my first big league camp the next year, and you just realize it's not just a ability wise, it's an opportunity. It's a pecking order. And then the team always has another agenda that they're working that you have no idea what it is.
So 2010, you have one of the more interesting call-up stories that that I've seen so far on the show. Walk me through that experience.
So I was in, we were at home in Sacramento. I get a text message from Schlossnagel after a game, and he goes, "Hey, did you get traded?" And I said, "What are you talking about?" He goes, "Oh, nothing. I just had somebody reach out to me. I was just curious if you heard anything." So I had no idea. I asked him what he was talking about, who reached out. He would not respond to me. And then I get a phone.
That's KG in itself right there. Like, oh, no, I broke some news I shouldn't have broke.
Yeah, I was like, what the hell is going on? And so the next morning I get a phone call at about 7:45 in the morning, which is crazy early for having a night game that day. And it's my agent, and he goes, "Hey man, how you feeling?" I go, "I'm tired. Like, it's 7:30 in the morning. What are you doing?" He goes, "They haven't called you yet, have they?" "Hasn't called me with what?" He goes, "Shit, I wasn't supposed to tell you this." He goes, "But man, you just got traded to the Diamondbacks. You're going to the big leagues, and you're meeting the team in Boston tonight." And I just was like, first of all, at 7:45, don't screw with me. He's like, "No, seriously, David Force was supposed to call you already." And so I'm like trying to figure this out. Like, this is amazing. And so then Force calls me like 6 minutes later, and I answer right away. He goes, "You already know, don't you?" So I jumped on a plane 4 hours later. My wife met me out there. We got in 11:30 at night. We go from Sacramento to the Ritz-Carlton in Boston. And then the next day was making my debut, get to the field. The only day in my entire career where I wanted to go out for batting practice, and it got rained out. And then I think the funniest thing was when I came in that night. I came in the eighth inning. We were down, I think, 5-3. And coming in Fenway, and the entire stadium's chanting "Beat LA" because the Celtics are playing the Lakers for the NBA championship. And I was like, nobody has a clue I'm here. And it was fantastic. But that was, and it started off with face JD Drew, Adrian Beltre, and Mike Cameron for my first three.
And you went 1-2-3. So I was going to ask you, you go in, you're facing those guys, and those are guys. Beltre is going to be a Hall of Famer. JD Drew made all the money. Mike Cameron is the GOAT. Are you thinking about, okay, this is what I have to do, you know, I got to attack these guys this way, kind of going through your process as you normally would, or are you just on the mound like, oh my God, that's Adrian Beltre?
Well, you know what the funny thing was, is when I got in there and that jog in, I was like, this is surreal. And my, you know, heart's pounding at 100 miles an hour. I get on the mound, I start going through my warm-up routine. And what was funny, what really calmed me, and it was a weird thing, but Jim Joyce was behind the plate. He was the umpire back there, plate umpire. And it was literally like a week after the Armando Galarraga thing, where he screwed up the call first base.
He's just the most miserable man on the planet at that point.
It was super nice. And he was like, "Hey, do you want your ball?" And I looked at him and I was like, wow, you just made such a bad mistake a week ago. And it kind of got my mind off of everything. I got up there and I think I spiked my first pitch and then locked in. But it was really humbling and really interesting to see it at that moment of where I was at. And it kind of calmed me in a weird way.
So to tie in a lot of the things that you had just mentioned, you know, suddenly you're staying at the Ritz-Carlton in Boston. You're on the big league roster the rest of that year. You're making more money. You're suddenly living the big league life. I'm curious, and based off what one of the ventures that you and your wife have now, is there any wine culture in the big leagues? I think you mentioned the NBA, you know, the NBA finals. There's now this like NBA wine group of guys. Like, you're always hearing like LeBron James talk about wine. You and your wife have a wine venture that we'll get into. How do you spend your social life? Is there a wine culture, or is it still beers in the clubhouse? Like, how did that come into your life essentially?
Well, so the wine aspect of it, it's not necessarily the indulging in the wine drinking. Jennifer and I have always been kind of that entrepreneurial type mindset. We were flipping houses while I was in the minor leagues, and in the big leagues, we were, you know, doing some investing in rental properties and some more flips and on the real estate side. But what we've always watched were different industries coming to Texas, and it was always 5 years later. We'd be on the West Coast and we'd see Orange Theory. And, you know, what was out there was Delicious Deliveries. Now we call it Uber Eats and the other aspects. And we kept watching all this stuff, and we'd come back home and people would be like, man, have you ever heard of this place? Like, yeah, 5 years ago, Jennifer was doing it in L.A. or, you know, in the Orange Theory. Or, yeah, we had Delicious Deliveries in Scottsdale for the last 4 years. What are you guys talking about? Oh, no, it just came here. So we kind of started going out and looking for different opportunities to bring that we thought would be concepts that would eventually come here, but how do we get them here first? And that's kind of where we fell into on the wine side. We were actually in Napa on our 10-year anniversary, and we ran into it and just said, you know, let's just do it. And 2 weeks later, we had a lease on the place in Fort Worth. So it's more of finding things to bring here that challenge us, that we see as fits and something that we can spread.
So while you were playing, you were already planning for life after baseball. Even like you're a rookie in the big leagues, like you're on the ascent. You guys were already thinking about just things and other aspects for life after baseball.
Yeah. I mean, I've got Jennifer, my wife, is extraordinarily intelligent. She graduated TCU business school with a 4.0 in real estate and finance. And there was no keeping her from enjoying, like, working and building something. And so, you know, it was one of those things that I knew, we both knew, it didn't matter how much time we spent in the big leagues, how much money we made in the big leagues, that there was always an end. No matter what, there's always an end to that career. And so we decided to make sure that we weren't a statistic. We weren't, you know, had a great run of it, great lifestyle, but when it's all said and done, now how do you live? You know, that's the biggest problem. How do you go from making that money in the big leagues to making $50,000 a year and living a lifestyle that you're enjoying after living that lifestyle for that long period of time? So we started setting ourselves up pretty early when we had the ability to.
Well, back to that time in the big leagues, you're obviously, while you're there, trying to stay there. With you go from the high leverage back end of the bullpen situations in the minors, you're closing games at most of your stops. You get to the D-backs and more of your opportunities are lower leverage opportunities on that team. Is there, I guess, are low leverage big league situations more high pressure than high pressure minor league, like, save situations?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. Just the adrenaline, the atmosphere, what it means when you're there. It's definitely much more, it's more high leverage even in a low leverage situation, because your job, your career, your future's on the line with what you're doing. You know, opening day in 2011 was my first full season, and Gibby comes up to me and he goes, you know, he's telling everybody their roles in the outfield before the first game. And he told me, he goes, you're going to be my fireman. I was like, well, what does that mean? He goes, whenever I need you to get me the hell out of something, I'm bringing you. And to this day, I still don't know what he meant, but it was always runner on first with one out, bases loaded, one out, first and second, one out, nobody out, get me out of the situation. And so it was,
you're the flex seal. He wanted, there's a leak and you're the flex tape. There's a leak and you got to plug it.
Wanted a ground ball to short. You know, he wanted me to get us double play. He brought me in that first night against Tulo, was up, runner on second with one out. And I get to the mound. He goes, I want you to throw four balls straight at Tulo. Don't let him put anything in play, and then get a double play from Helton. I was like, all right, could you just have the last guy walk too low and then bring me in? But that was Gibby. It was awesome. So it was just different situations and learning it. And I got utilized a lot early on. I had these shoulder troubles right around, I think, end of June that year. And it took me a long time to bounce back from that. But it's a lot tougher when you don't have an established role in the big leagues, but it's also one of those things where you have to establish yourself to get it. Coming up through the minor leagues, it was always prospects are always established in what they're going to do because they view them as we're training you to do this job in the big leagues, or we're trying to get you to that place so you have that established role. Once you get to the big leagues, it's about being one of eight in the bullpen or seven in the bullpen, and how do you survive?
And once you, if you get to that point, you haven't established a role, you start doing the org shuffle, because suddenly, you know, those relievers are the most expendable for the 40-man spot, or when they're out of options and things like that. You start doing the shuffle, waivers to the Astros, then to the Yankees, then to the Dodgers. Does it matter whose mound you pitch on? Like, do any of those orgs kind of put their hands on you and say, we want you to try this or be different in this way? Or is it you are you and the mound, the organization, the jersey doesn't really matter?
I learned that real quick, yeah. I mean, once I went to Houston and then in spring training got shipped over to the Yankees, it was more along the lines of I just want a mound to throw off of and a team to play for. And then my mindset was, in order to have the opportunity to play on a playoff team and worry about that, you've got to establish yourself. And it's more of the opportunity as opposed to the winning of the pennant or any of that at that nature. My first, 3 years with Arizona, it was all about, that 2011 season when we won the West and go to play the Brewers. I mean, that was electric. That was phenomenal. I loved just the adrenaline, just of a playoff game, just being there. But, in the same situation, if you don't have the opportunity to suit up, does it really matter if you're not there? And that's what was tough there. I struggled a little bit when I came back from the shoulder stuff, and Brad Ziegler takes my roster spot the next day after throwing really well all year. It was, well, we're going to bring somebody else in to take you. They trade for somebody and send you down, and you're just, you realize that the business of that at that moment. So it's more important to have the opportunity to establish and get comfortable than it is to, win at that point. You look at guys that have struggled at their first part of their career and then blossomed into big careers. You look at where they start at. You look at Greg Maddux with Chicago. He wasn't throwing up 3-0, a 2.1 every year in his first 2 years. He was a 5.5 until he learned how to pitch. And then you look at Arrieta in Baltimore. Baltimore wasn't winning pennants. They had the ability to give him the chance to struggle. I think that second year before he got traded to Chicago, he had almost a 7 ERA. And then he gets a new life, and you see him blossom. So the situation that you're in has a lot to do with the ability to establish, and then you go for it.
Did you have the roadmap for yourself on if you'd gotten another shot in the big, like you'd had that experience, and were there a couple things where you said, if I can improve on this, this, and this, or I can change now that I know how life is in the big leagues and how these hitters are, if I know what I need to do, did you have a roadmap of these are the changes I'm going to make, and that's going to make me a more successful big league pitcher than my first stint?
Yes. Yeah. For me, it was my first stint up there was all about pitching to how they wanted me to throw at that moment. Like, I'd give you one in ground ball, so it was sinker cutters. I'd never utilized my changeup. I probably threw 3% changeups in my time in the big leagues. Well, my changeup was my best pitch. It's my, it's my punch out pitch. And so when I got sent down, it was like, okay, I got to get back to me. I got to get back to away from pitching to this much contact in these situations and understanding when it's time to put somebody away. And, it's really difficult because you're at a place where somebody tells you to do something and they have the ability to send you out and change your life. I mean, when I got traded to the big leagues or traded to the Diamondbacks and called up to the big leagues, I went from making $2,500 a month to $2,600 a day. That's a massive change in lifestyle, a massive change where it's, well, I've got to be able to succeed at this level. What do they need me to do? And that initial change in just the everyday mindset, even slightly where you don't realize it, can have a massive impact on everything. And so when I went down and I got to reestablish myself as where I saw my weaknesses and my strengths and work on them and getting that back. I was ready for the opportunity. But I never got the second shot. And then, you know, tried to become a starter and throw 100 pitches in an outing and Tommy John 2 weeks later.
Well, with Tommy John, we, especially as fans now, we kind of take it for granted. Okay, he's out for a year. He's going to be back next year.
Yeah.
Back, you know, back the same. Is that what you thought when you heard those words?
So I knew it was going to be a long road on mine. And then Andrews did the surgery. And then when I got to post off with him, Dr. Andrews said, well, that was the worst one I've ever done. Your rehab's going to be miserable.
And he's done a few.
He's done a few. Yeah. He pulled out 4 bone chips about the size of quarters, gave them to me in one of the little medical things. Funny story on that is we left it in a VRBO in Arizona while I was rehabbing, left it in the freezer. So somebody got a real nice surprise in there.
But this might be floating around on eBay at some point.
So it was a really rough rehab. It was about 18 months, but I did come back strong. I was throwing the ball really well and everything was there except for me. I'd had 16 months of being at home with my kids, taking them to school, picking them up from school, starting to work on some stuff on the real estate side and doing all this rehab, and then watching a few games on TV, but not really being involved in baseball for that period of time. And when I got back to full strength and I was ready to go for spring training, I went out to Arizona to throw for a couple of teams. And after the first day, I was like, you know what? I don't want to be away from my kids anymore. I don't want to do this and go get a minor league opportunity and do the same thing I did the last 2 years. So I made the choice there to go home and call it a day.
A lot of the times when we get to this point in an episode, it's like, well, you know, how did you decide what you were going to do next? What is, you know, how do you fill that void? Is it scary? It sounds like the steps that you had taken while you were coming on up in the minors and diversifying your interest and thinking about life after baseball, was it a pretty effortless, you know, off ramp? Was it easy to say I'm done? Any fear there, anything like that at all?
I mean, there wasn't. It was pretty easy for me to make that decision at that point. I proved to myself I could get back to full strength and full health. The velocity was back up. The movement was there. I felt good from that standpoint. And I think if I wouldn't have done that, if I would have just called it a day during that rehab process, there would have been regrets. Knowing that I was back to full strength and could compete and made that decision to go ahead and walk away at that point, I think it was the best thing I could have done for myself. I didn't have any regrets of walking at that point. I've had a few moments of like, man, I missed the clubhouse. I missed the competition on that side. That's been the hardest thing to replace or to find an alternative aspect for. So, you know, I played some basketball, you know, now it's golf. It's just, it's always finding a place to have that competitive outreach and our competitive outlet, and then having the group of guys where you can still, you know, have that clubhouse mentality.
Golf is the absolute go-to too, because you're going to be competing against yourself forever on that one.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I love it. And I think that for me was the reason why I could step away. I set it up for myself. We set it up for our family, but I gave myself the ability to get back and still made the decision.
Like we mentioned, you wear a lot of different hats now. The wine venture that we mentioned, if you're ever in Fort Worth or my hometown of Bernie, Texas, folks, 38th and Vine, it's awesome, wonderful place. How has baseball helped in your post-business life, and has it hurt at all?
It helps it from the standpoint that there's always a conversation with people. As soon as people find out I play baseball, that's what they want to talk about. And as soon as we can talk about something of that nature, they become comfortable. It's just how it is. Like, people are always looking how to connect to somebody. And, you know, what I mainly do is residential and commercial real estate. That's my main avenue. The wine bars, the coffee shop, the expansion on all of that. My wife runs most of that at this point, and my job is just I do some business meetings and things of that on the expansion. But Real estate's really where I'm at, and that's the communication game. That's the relationships. Everything I do is based off referrals, based off of people coming to me, and it's all built through trust and responsibility and reliability. And coming up through baseball, you know, there's only one person that can make you or break you, and it's you. And it's the same thing in real estate. It's the same thing with the restaurants and expanding those. It's trusting yourself, trusting your gut, and going for it. Because at the end of the day, if you don't, nobody else will, and nobody else is going to make you money in this world. And so, you know, we've had a pretty, Jennifer likes to put it this way. We've already lived a life together, starting another one. So we have that opportunity to understand how to do it.
I'm in sales as well. And I always say that playing sports, but especially like baseball, is such a great crash course for how to be successful in sales or just in business in general. The experience in sharing a clubhouse or talking to and dealing with people from all different kinds of backgrounds is so invaluable. So I'm not surprised that you've been able to find the success that you've had, because it makes all the difference in the world. Just that life experience just through sport.
Well, it allows you to talk to somebody, you know, without any ulterior motives or anything like that. And I can build relationships with not having to, you know, I go into relationships with people where I never tell them what I do until they ask me what I do. And it's building trust, because at the end of the day, if I sell somebody a house or sell somebody a commercial building and they're at the same country club I am, I'm going to be seeing them on a weekly basis. And I don't want to cause any bad blood anywhere. It's just everything's relationship based.
Absolutely. So if you could go back and give yourself, your 21-year-old self, a pep talk right before you signed, what would that pep talk look like?
It would be the smartest words I ever heard and never followed until after my career. And it was Eric Young told me this. We're standing in the outfield. I'm going through my rehab process on my shoulder. And he looked at me and he goes, "Don't ever come back until you're 100%. He goes, "I don't care if you're 99%. Until you're 100, don't ever step on this field, because it will murder you." And I didn't really realize, I understood what he was saying, obviously, but to me, I wanted to get back because I wanted to be back on that mound. And when I came back off of my rehab assignment, I was probably 80%, 85%. But we were going to Oakland and playing at the Coliseum, where this is the team that drafted me. This is where I came up to my mind. I know all these guys. I wanted to be back for it. And I forced myself back, and it was the worst thing I could have done. And, you know, I translate that into, you know, in baseball, it was don't come back until you're 100% and you can put everything on the field. But in business and in everything of my, you know, that we have going on, it's don't make a decision. Don't do anything until you have 100% commitment behind it. You have 100% of your body behind it and your mind behind it, then we can make that decision. But if it's one of those weeks where we've been working 80 hours, it's 11 o'clock at night, it is shut it down. We'll make this decision tomorrow. And everything is always based off of the mindset of 100% towards it right now or shut it down.
Awesome. Well, I got a little quick rapid fire for you, then I'll let you get out of here.
Yeah.
Favorite minor league ballpark?
Ooh, minor league ballpark. Gosh, that one's tough. I really love Frisco because of the pool and just the atmosphere around there. Triple A wise, Durham by far.
Oh, the GOAT.
Yeah. Kane County was awesome, but I think it's changed. But yeah, those would be it. Frisco and then Durham. The Bull is
favorite off. Big, yeah. The Bull, just the experience. I've never been to a minor league game where the fans were as into the game as much as they are in Durham.
Yeah,
it's a wild experience. Favorite big league ballpark?
Easy, PNC, Pittsburgh.
The view.
The view is fantastic. The clubhouse is great there. The food was good, but that view is just unmatched.
Best hitter you ever faced?
Statistically, the best hitter I ever faced. Probably Pujols.
Or who? Yeah, I mean, or it could be who gave you the toughest time, who was the most intimidating. I mean, Pujols probably.
Yeah, the toughest the face was Casey McGee. Casey McGee is, I think, 5 for 7 off me with the cycle. And if you know, he was like 250 and didn't move very well. But I've had the worst at bats I've ever had were against him. And the first time I faced him, he ran, you know, we had an 8 or 9 pitch at bat. He shoots a single through the right side on me. He comes up to me the next day where I'm heading out the bullpen. He goes, "Man, your stuff's nasty. That's awesome. Keep doing it." And then he proceeds to just annihilate me for the next 2 years.
Favorite wine you've ever had?
Jay Davies. So the Jamie is, it's out of Napa. It is so good. It's like got a little chocolate hint to it. It's only, you can only get it from their winery out there.
And last one, everyone gets this. Do you have a nightmare bus ride story from the minor leagues?
Nightmare bus ride from the minor leagues?
Yeah. I mean, you played in the Texas League, so there's some brutal stretches in that one.
Yeah, but I was only there for like a month and a half. Texas League was brutal. I don't have any everything on the bus was a nightmare. You got people sleeping. I guess probably my worst one was the month where I was the guy on the floor. The guy that I had to share a seat with, we switched off. 1 month he would sleep on top of the bed or on top of the seat, and then the next other guy would sleep underneath. And it was I can remember his name, Mike Banaka. And he was probably 285 pounds, and he was a sweaty guy. And having him above me while I'm blanket on the floor was not fun.
Oh.
That was Texas. And then when he got up to AAA, he got up there the next year, and I looked at him and I go, "There ain't no way in hell you're sitting next to me."
That's a nightmare situation. Sam Dumble, that's all I've got for you. Thank you so much for joining from Phenom to the Farm.
Yeah, thanks so much.
And that's it for today's episode from Phenom to the Farm. Big thanks to Sam Dumble for coming on the show, walking us through his career. Again, if you enjoyed this episode, please remember to subscribe wherever you get your podcast, rate and leave a review if you're on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And remember, episodes come at you every other Tuesday, so we'll catch you in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.